Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class at Crossover Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 27, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Yasa Sutta. In the Yasa Sutta, the Buddha teaches how to develop wise associations and seclusion and to be free of entanglements. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So tonight's talk is on the Yasa Sutta. Well, let me just read it instead of explaining it. This short sutta teaches that developing the wisdom of the Buddha will bring the ability to avoid self-aggrandizing and the distraction that occurs from creating a Dhamma practice that is dependent on external entanglements as its theme. So I don't know if that's even clear what I just said. The Buddha never used any type of label to describe the original Sangha, the original people that were developing the Buddha's teachings. He just referred to them as a Sangha. He referred to the male members as bhikkhus, the female members were bhikkhunis, which has some different interpretations, but it basically means someone who is following the Buddha's teachings. The reason why that's significant is that there's a subtle form of eye-making that is possible when you start creating labels for your Sangha or for the practice that you're doing. He called his practice the Dhamma, which simply means the truth of or the true nature of the world. He never referred to himself as the Buddha or a Buddha even. Buddha, the word Buddha means awakened, and so that was a label given to him, the Buddha, the awakened one. He referred to himself only as the Tathagata, which simply means the one who has gone forth, which means the one who has left the world behind, and it signifies that he's the first one. He's the guy that figured this all out, and then he taught the rest of us. An awakened human being, using the Pali word, the word is Arahant. And it does. It simply means awakened. And the Buddha made a distinction between himself and other people that awakened only in the fact that he was the first one. And the reason why all that's important, it's so easy to create another self-identity, something else that we'll cling to. And so we could call ourselves the Flying Lotus Sangha. And now I'm part of the Flying Lotus Sangha. It's just a word. I'm not talking about anybody. It's a member of the Flying Lotus Sangha. Now I'm part of the Sangha. And that identity becomes more important than actually developing the Dhamma. So again, it was something that the Buddha avoided the entire time of he taught. Consistent participation with a well-focused Sangha is very important in developing a useful Dhamma practice, but overindulgence and dependence on a group practice is counterproductive to developing the Dhamma. While the Buddha always emphasized the importance of a well-focused Sangha, he also taught that Dhamma practice depends on and flourishes in seclusion. So there's a balance here. If our Dhamma practice is only being part of the Thursday night group, we're not going to gain the full benefit of the Dhamma. That aspect of taking refuge in our own seclusion, in our own meditation practice, is so important in developing a wholehearted and well-rounded Dhamma practice. It's not just sitting with a group. And it's not just identifying with a group or the group's proclivities. What happens is that you a kind of group identity then starts to form, and serving that group identity becomes more important than simply developing the Dhamma. And this is something that the Buddha recognized 2,600 years ago pretty quickly, and that's what the sutta is about. The Buddha was teaching in Ikkhanagala. The locals all knew of the Buddha as a rightly self-awakened human being who was unexcelled as a teacher and whose teachings are entirely useful and practical. They were a close-knit group who depended on their group for direction and guidance rather than the Buddha's direct teachings. They prepared a feast with many delicacies for the Buddha and his Sangha. They approached the Buddha's dwelling and began making a noisy racket. The venerable Nagita was attending the Buddha, and the Buddha asked Nagita what that racket was all about. The Gita replied, "Great teacher, those are the locals who have brought many delicacies to honor you and the Sangha." The Buddha replied, "Nagita, I do not seek honor or recognition." Immediately he sees the problem. Now, he didn't he didn't refuse people that wanted to honor him in a certain way, but a very simple way. When you met the Buddha, it was known that you usually would bow down, and that's just a simple sign of respect. I do it here too. It doesn't mean that the Buddha is anything special, except he's a human being that deserves respect. So he immediately picked up on this, and he's trying to make the point to not see him as something in any special way. He continues, "Whoever cannot obtain through their own understanding and with ease, as I do, the pleasure of renunciation, the pleasure of seclusion, the pleasure of peace, the pleasure of self-awakening, let them consent to this common pleasure, this dulling pleasure, this pleasure born of gain and of receiving offerings of fame." The Buddha has recognized that the locals have created a group identity through their association that overemphasized their association, that created a type of worship of the Buddha that dismissed important aspects of the Eightfold Path and allowed them to avoid seclusion. In other words, they were just substituting their group identity as Dhamma practice, and that group identity became enough for them. The Gita says, "Great teacher, please relent now. The locals will follow you because of your virtue and understanding." Again, the Gita, "I do not seek honor or recognition. Whoever cannot obtain through their own understanding and with ease, as I do, the pleasure of renunciation, the pleasure of seclusion, the pleasure of peace, the pleasure of self-awakening, let them consent to this common pleasure, this dulling pleasure, this pleasure born of gain and of receiving offerings and fame. There are many who are unable to develop the understanding with ease that leads to the pleasure of renunciation," etc. I'll say that again. "When people all live together, assemble together, and live committed to dwelling with a group, they are unable to develop understanding with ease, which is why they live together, assemble together, and live committed to dwelling with a group. Nagita, when I see a community delighting in their interactions, laughing loudly, grabbing at one another, I know they will not be able to develop the pleasure of renunciation," etc. Which is why they are delighting in their interactions, laughing loudly and grabbing at one another. So again, they've substituted this social sangha as a substitute for developing the Dhamma. And the Buddha's not saying, the Buddha was never some dour man who never wanted to laugh and never wanted to have any real enjoyment or social interaction, but only when it was appropriate. And he was very clear on not making your sangha and the direct practice of the Dhamma a social engagement. It was something different. So the typical day for members of the Buddha sangha was that they would meditate early in the morning, they would get up and walk into town and get their food for the day, and they would come back, they'd work quietly, maintaining the grounds and whatever they had to take care of there at the sangha, and they would meditate a little bit later on. And at night, they might hear a talk from the Buddha, or they might just go to bed early. But there was not a lot of partying in the sangha. They lived a very quiet and secluded life. And even outside of a sangha, and so none of us live 24/7 in a sangha. But why this sutta is important is to remember to create that atmosphere at least during our meditation practice. And don't start substituting the group, any group, for your Dhamma practice. The Dhamma doesn't lend itself to social interaction in that way. It should be looked at as something that we keep very pure and keep our focus on it. If we start creating special things about the Sangha, we're just going to lose our way, and that's what he's talking about here. "There are those communities who revel in food, eating as much as they want, who take pleasure in sensory contact, pleasure in lying down, pleasure in dullness." And really what the Buddha is talking about is the idea of continually eating lavish meals or always engaging in social interaction leads to dullness. It's another form of clinging. It's another form of attachment. It's another form of entanglement in the world. And he's talking very clearly about looking at that. Again, he's not saying we should never enjoy ourselves, but to look closely at our entanglements and the identities we're making over those entanglements, and specifically in our Buddhist practice. "I know that they will not be able to develop the pleasure of renunciation, the pleasure of seclusion, the pleasure of peace, the pleasure of self-awakening. Haven't eaten as much as they want, taking pleasure from sensory contact, from lying down in dullness. Then there are those who attempt to develop concentration in a community where disturbance is likely, meaning it doesn't lend itself to quietness. And that can even be part of a so-called sangha, where your social interaction and the talks about application of the Dhamma and what you might be doing, and did you read this book, and did you hear this podcast, and did you do... All of that can be a distraction to the Dhamma. And I don't know if you notice here, but I try to keep it very well focused on just what the Buddha taught. And there's really no other way to present the Dhamma. There's always been, not so much lately, when I first started teaching, there were folks that came in and out that wanted me to talk about different things, or they wanted to listen to other tapes of other teachers, such as, you know, why don't, once in a while we'll listen to Pema Chodron, or we'll listen to Mark Epstein, or we'll listen to this person or that person. Why don't we play these videos? And I've always resisted that because it was important to me to just have a place in the world where just the Buddha's teachings are presented, for a lot of reasons, but mostly because that's the path that we're all after. If we're seeking peace and understanding, the Buddha figured out a way to do that 2,600 years ago, and his teachings are still relevant. And even during his times, he's noticing the need for people to start adapting or embellishing his teachings to create a social atmosphere out of developing the Dhamma. There are those who... we read that. There are those who attempt to develop concentration in a community where disturbance is likely. This, I know, is not conducive to developing the Dhamma. But those that have found the root of a tree or an empty hut... That's how we always describe how to establish a meditation practice. Nothing elaborate, not a lot of instruction. Go find the root of a tree or an empty hut, meaning remove yourself from the world for a short while and meditate, engage in shamatha vipassana meditation. Even though they may be drowsy, they will dispel their drowsiness and be mindful of their seclusion. Then there are those who have established seclusion and are not well concentrated. Meditating in seclusion, they will quickly develop concentration and will protect their concentration. They will end their distracted mind and be mindful of their seclusion. Then there are those that have established seclusion and are well concentrated. They will develop clinging release, meaning they will develop full awakening, full human maturity. They have found the benefit from seclusion. Then there are those that cling to a group and take food, clothes, shelter, and recognition from the group and become enamored with the group. Again, this is just group self-identity. They do not establish seclusion and will not end distraction. So there was a time, and I've got to be very careful about identifying the group because I don't want to. For quite a few years, I practiced in a certain very well-established worldwide tradition. And I would go to a certain place, a couple hours drive, usually once a month. They had a beautiful meditation center. It was really remarkable, very elaborate. And we would do a lot of the usual things in silence, like meals were always taken in silence. But one of the things that got me, they had posted that every morning at 10 a.m. is the meditation. And so when I first started going there, every morning at 10 a.m. I'd go into this beautiful meditation hall and I'd sit. And the first few times I waited and waited and waited, and nobody ever showed up. And so I would go ahead and meditate. And I did that almost by myself. Every now and then somebody else would come and sit with me. But for a couple of years, I did that. And one day, I decided to ask one of the monks that was living there. I said, do I have the time wrong? Am I doing something? What's the problem here? I'm here every morning at 10 o'clock, and hardly anybody ever joins me. He says, oh, we all meditate at 10 o'clock there. Okay. I never saw you. It must be. It was so conditioned in their mind that they were doing it, but they weren't actually doing this. But what they had every afternoon was this gathering, 3 o'clock. And so in the beginning, I would join the gathering, and it was a lot of people. Some of the locals would get together, and they would rarely talk about the Dhamma, and there was very little actual teachings of what the Buddha taught, but they all reveled in this wonderful gathering that they had. And, it took me a while to figure out that that wasn't for me, but again, the Buddha is talking specifically to this. So, Nagita, then there are those well-established in seclusion who receive food, clothes, shelter, and recognition from a group knowing the benefit of seclusion and restraint, no disturbance will arise in them. So that's the end of the sutta. It's just a little commentary on it. The Yasa Sutta shows the importance of dismissing praise, even in very subtle ways, for developing the Dhamma. It also shows how seeking external validation for Dhamma practice will lead to further distraction and confusion, meaning through group confirmation and confirmation, meaning you're, what's more important to your Dhamma practice is that everybody, a lot of people are doing it rather than something that the Buddha actually taught. The Buddha presents very simple and direct meditation instruction and consistently teaches to find the root of a tree or an empty hut for meditation and seclusion. Throughout the Pali Canon, the Buddha teaches the importance of seclusion as a singularly necessary component of meditation practice. While the Buddha Sangha would occasionally meditate as a group, they would congregate as a community primarily to hear a teaching by the Buddha or from one of the senior nuns or monks. In other words, they didn't sit in meditation every day or every night together. Most of their practice was, even though they were living with a large group, very quickly the Buddha Sangha grew to nearly 1,000 people after only a month. But they meditated as a singular practice. And they came together as a group when it was appropriate, meaning to hear something from the Buddha or maybe to have some kind of organizational meeting. But even though they were living as a group, they didn't create an identity as a group. They were simply meditators. They were simply bhikkhus and bhikkhunis of the Buddha Sangha. In the Bala Sutta, the Buddha asked Sariputta of the importance of seclusion and the Eightfold Path to end the defilements of craving, aversion, and deluded thinking. Sariputta said, "The mind of a monk whose defilements are ended inclines towards seclusion, leans towards seclusion, tends towards seclusion, stays in seclusion, and delights in renunciation, entirely rid of the qualities that act as a basis for the defilements. The fact that the mind of a monk whose defilements are ended inclines towards seclusion and in renunciation, entirely rid of the qualities that act as a basis for the defilements, is also a strength of a monk whose defilements have ended." In other words, a lot of words are just to reinforce the idea that seclusion is an important part of our Dhamma practice. There's some more to that sutta, but I think I made my point. Another way of making the point about the importance of seclusion as part of our Dhamma practice, one of the most difficult things that people have when they begin a meditation practice is that simple act of sitting quietly by yourself for a few minutes. In fact, it's the agitation that arises in the beginning that forces most people to just say, "I can't do this. This isn't for me." If we continue with our practice, and again, that's the Buddha is encouraging us to do that, and I hope that I am too. That act of simply sitting quietly by ourselves, without any entanglements with the world, without any, distractions to the world. Just there's the Buddha. Most of the depictions of the Buddha are not him doing anything else but just sitting. There's the Buddha. That's the example that he showed us. That's the importance of developing seclusion. And then off our cushions, it's okay to develop some seclusion off our cushions, meaning we don't always have to be engaged with the outside world. We don't always have to be on the internet or connected to Facebook or tweeting this and all the other things that we do. We can practice restraint and withdraw our attention from the outside world even just for a short while, even just for a few extra minutes a day. And that will have a profound effect on developing a calm and peaceful mind, which is why we're all here. So that's the end of the talk today. Thank you. We'll go around the room. Are there any questions about the Yasa Sutta before we do that? Oh, okay. Stefan, good to see you tonight. Any thoughts or comments, questions?
Not really. I think the sutta has sort of triggered me to reflect on some sanghas I've been part of in the past, to kind of think about what aspects of those group dynamics were really helpful and what aspects were sort of distracting. Seems like kind of a mixed bag, but it's interesting to reflect on that a little bit.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. The same was true for me. I didn't realize it until I kind of left all that behind. And it's also helpful to realize that this was a common problem 2,600 years ago, where the Buddha wouldn't taught it. So, thanks for saying it. Jane, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you.
Yeah. Any questions or comments? Or?
No questions. I guess just an observation that I made was I noticed that when I try to pay attention like to the full sensory experience of breathing, that it's I'm more able to focus, like the sound of the breath too, and like how it feels like throughout my body, not just like right here.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think when I try to focus on more sensations,
that's
use different senses, that I can be more focused.
Yeah, good for you. You're able to maintain the method that way. You recognize that you're caught up in your thoughts, and you come back to that sensation of breathing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the meditation practice, and then it only deepens the more you do it. And I know you've heard me say this, and the more that you start integrating the entire Eightfold Path as part of your meditation practice, it's not just meditation. But,
right.
Yeah. I'm so glad you came tonight. It's good
Thank
to see you.
You
again. Robin, how are you? Good to see you.
Good.
Oh, good.
Which helps a lot. Because I couldn't seem to get past like 10 or 15 minutes. But if I turn on the guided meditation, it's like, it seems very easy to
watch.
So it's very helpful.
I'm so glad. Yeah, that is. A lot of people use it. In fact, I got an email just today saying, you know, would you mind putting one up for 30 minutes? Because 20 is not enough, so I will. I'm glad you're finding it useful. Joe, good to see you tonight.
John, good to be here. Still sitting, enjoying it, and I use your voice as well. I find it very helpful just to stay focused. And I'm able to do it. I'm able to come back to the sensation of breathing from thoughts. Sometimes mostly thoughts, getting caught up in thoughts and then coming back to it. Not for very long periods of time, am I able to focus?
That's fine.
It's getting better.
Yeah, and that's it, Joe. That's the meditation practice, and we do it primarily for deepening concentration. So, and the reason I'm saying that, it really doesn't matter. We'd all love to sit down and say, I'm going to meditate for 20 minutes, and I focus on my breath. 20 minutes go by, and I haven't had a thought. It's not possible. We're human beings. Thoughts are supposed to be ongoing. The purpose of meditation is to not be distracted by those thoughts. And so every time we recognize that we're caught up in our thoughts again and come back to our breath, we're deepening our concentration. So you can look at it that, in fact, it should be looked at that when you find that you're caught up in your thoughts, don't even judge that. Don't get frustrated with that. Don't think that you're doing something wrong. Just come back to the sensation of breathing. The four foundations of mindfulness speak to that a little bit, even though they've been misapplied too. It's just meditation should be something that we're doing in seclusion. And one of the things that's good about seclusion is nobody's watching us. Nobody's checking on us. Nobody's making sure we're doing it right. Come back to the sensation of breathing. That's all. And over time, as we integrate the rest of the Eightfold Path, we will develop profound concentration. So just to make the point again, the reason why we use meditation for deepening concentration and not for a lot of the other applications, which are really more contemplation or analyzing mundane objects, or to focus just on a general type of insight, that's not meditation. But practice within the framework of the Eightfold Path, that deepening concentration then supports the refined mindfulness to hold in mind the entire Eightfold Path as the framework for our life. And that's where awakening comes from. That's why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path. You know, he wouldn't, if there was no reason for it, he wouldn't have spent 45 years of his life teaching that path and really nothing else.
John, how would you use the four foundations of mindfulness? And like, the word I'm using is used like for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Because although I understand like what the words say, I'm not sure of their use.
It's such a great question. Thank you, Joe. And again, it's something else. There's the Buddha taught mindfulness in two applications. In the Satipatthana Sutta, he teaches the four foundations of mindfulness. And then often when he would teach the Eightfold Path, he would teach to be mindful of each factor of the Eightfold Path. In other words, if you find that you're telling a lie or maybe speaking angrily towards someone, that's wrong speech. And he's taught to be mindful when you're engaged in wrong speech. And the words that he would use was enter and remain. In other words, start using right speech. Be mindful of that. Be mindful of right view. Be mindful of right intention. Those are the two applications of mindfulness. And again, he didn't teach it any other way. In the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, there's this long, elaborate talk about called the charnel grounds. The charnel grounds are grave sites, or cemeteries. And to contemplate what happens there, what happens to a human body when it decomposes. And the Buddha goes through the process of, and I won't go through it because it is pretty gross, of this happens and that happens and the body gets eaten by worms. And people have made a meditation practice over that. When the Buddha was simply saying, be mindful, don't be so enamored with your body, because look what happens to everyone. It rots away. And that's the only reason he taught that. I know I'm getting a little bit away from your question. But people have made meditation on the charnel grounds a meditation practice when it was never meant that way. So the Buddha taught four foundations of mindfulness to bring dispassion to what occurs in a meditation practice. So the four foundations of mindfulness are form, feeling, thoughts, sometimes called perceptions, and ongoing consciousness. The first foundation of mindfulness. Form, being mindful of the breath in the body, is how the Buddha taught that. And then what that means is to start bringing our focus into what's occurring right now. We have a human body. Be mindful of that and be mindful of your breath in your body. That begins the concentration practice. It starts taking our focus from outside of ourselves and starts bringing it within. And then the second foundation is feelings. Now, feelings in this context is any disturbance in the mind. Any agitation, any movement in the mind in this context is a feeling. So be mindful of the breath in the body, and then be mindful of feelings arising. Be mindful of agitation in the mind. And what do you do with it? Come back to the sensation of breathing. What he's teaching is to stop being so reactionary. Stop having a reactive mind to simple things that are coming up all the time. Develop this passion about feelings. Then the next foundation is thoughts, and that's feelings and thoughts. Feelings can drive thoughts. In other words, I can have this feeling of fear, and the next thought is something that's attached to that fear, like, I think I'm going to lose my job tomorrow. It's that type of thing. Sometimes a thought can drive a feeling, so it's not strictly linear. Sometimes it might feel like a thought. A thought pops into my head that I'm going to lose my job, and the feeling is fear. You see what I'm talking about? These are mundane aspects that happen to everyone. The reason why the Buddha is teaching it is to simply be mindful of it and be mindful of your reaction to these things, to these normal, mundane, everyday occurrences. And that leads to the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And I say it at the end of every meditation session. Notice the quality of your mind. What that's pointing to is to recognize the process of reacting to feelings and reacting to thoughts and how that results in a quality of mind that is itself agitated. Or as we deepen our concentration and we notice that the quality of our mind is still at peace. And even that could sound like it's almost too simple to be useful, but it's so important because we recognize that we're actually gaining control of our mind, which is what concentration means. Again, concentration isn't something that's bestowed on us or just happens. But we can develop it. We can develop it pretty quickly, and it's all up to us. So the four foundations of mindfulness. I begin to meditate. I'm mindful of my breath and my body. My focus is now coming within, and I'm able to notice feelings arising. And I'm noticing that I'm reacting to that feeling. It's distracting me. But the instruction is, when a distraction arises, when I find that I'm caught up in my thoughts again, come back to the sensation of breathing. Notice that I don't have to figure out where the feeling came from, or who's the root of it, who's to blame for it. What should I do about it? I notice that I'm distracted. I'm focused on a feeling. Come back to the sensation of breathing. And then I might notice in the next moment that I'm caught up in this story about my life. I don't have to figure out where it came from. The Buddha is teaching me in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness to recognize that I'm caught up in this story again. I'm caught up in my thoughts. Come back to the sensation of breathing. And if all that fails, I always have the benchmark of the present quality of my mind. And so if I've missed the feelings and the thoughts, and I now find myself in a very agitated state, or maybe a dull state, my meditation might have taken me to a point where I'm just, ugh. Recognize that. That's not meditation either. Some people like that because it feels like an escape. You're not thinking about anything in particular. But that's not concentration either. It's just distraction. Recognize the quality of your mind. If it's agitated, be at peace with it. I know you've all heard me say that we can be at peace with less than peaceful mind states. That's what meditation and the Four Foundations of Mindfulness teach us, very directly in meditation. So when something occurs off our cushion, I'll just use the example. I'm going to a funeral tomorrow from a man that I really love. He's a great guy. I'm sad about it. Like, I should be. It's an appropriate feeling. But I haven't lost my mind over it. I'm at peace with that. When I think about this man, I'm at peace with being sad. I should be. I don't have to figure out what's wrong and I shouldn't feel this way or blame someone, blame a supreme being for taking people's lives. That's silly. I can be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state. And we can do that. Maybe I'm using an example that's not, I think it's a good example, but another one might be that I got into an argument with someone earlier today. I didn't. But recounting it, I don't have to continue, that guy is so bad, and why did he do this, and how could people act like that, and how could somebody treat me? It's something that occurred. I can be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state. That's the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And if you notice that quality of your mind is agitated, what do you do about it? Maybe you meditate for a couple more minutes, and you develop the broader framework of the Eightfold Path, because that will help you develop deep concentration and that refined mindfulness to recognize these changing mind states rather than reacting to it. All of us have had something occur in our life, and it creates a quality of our mind that might last for days. And it feels like we're never going to be able to get out of that. And for some people, it does lead to psychosis because you can't get out of it. We've all had that. And it might just be for a half an hour, or 4 or 5 hours. Or we might have a bad day because of the quality of our mind. Well, this is something that can get us out of that because we can recognize in the moment that this is my present quality of mind, but all mind states are impermanent. This is teaching towards the impermanent nature of all thoughts, anicca, anatta, and dukkha. If I don't need the quality of my mind to be any different right now, it will pass a lot quicker. I can maintain a peaceful and calm mind. So what is a long talk on a simple question? I hope I answered it. Okay, good. Any questions about that? You know, again, one more point. Excuse me for going on tonight. If there's something in Buddhism in general that seems too complicated to even understand, it's likely not something that the Buddha taught. And that doesn't mean at first we should have complete understanding of everything he taught. But it should point to there's something in the Buddha's direct teachings that will explain what you don't understand in this moment. There's a word that he used, ehipasiko, come and see for yourself. What he means is you have to engage in the Dhamma, then you can see for yourself. And then later on, he would say, and this is something that has led to all kinds of foolishness, just to use the word. The Buddha said that we should question everything. But what he meant by that is, this is when he was alive. He didn't say, here's my teaching, and he taught this for 45 years, and he said, question it, and if you don't like it, do something else. He said, question it, meaning question me, when he was alive, Come, and he actually said that. Come to me directly if you have a question about what I'm teaching. Ask me the question. Now, of course, we can't do that today, can we? But the written record, the Dhamma, is still here. And we can go and we can look at that. And when I did that, that's when it changed everything. That's when it made sense. That's when the Mahasatipatthana Sutta made complete sense instead of me meditating on rotten bodies. You know, and all the other things that I was so confused about. The answers are right there in the Dhamma. And they're usually very simple. If it seems like it's too complicated, it's probably not something that the Buddha taught. Even something like dependent origination of the five clinging aggregates, you have to look at them in context. And when in context, and when they're taken in context, they become rather easy to understand. So, and that's kind of the... I just published another book called Becoming Buddha. And that's what that explains. And that's what the Nagara Sutta that I mentioned. And the Nagara Sutta, the Buddha teaches... Excuse me. Directly, his process of awakening. He talks about it. He explains it in relation to the dependent origination and the Eightfold Path. He references them directly. So there's no even... it's often presented that we don't really know what the Buddha, how the Buddha awakened or what he awakened to. There's a legend, and I often... It's not entirely a legend. There's a story about the Buddha's awakening that I often recount. But this is how the Buddha's directly saying, this is what I did. And he's talking about everything that he taught and that we talk about here too. It's not all that complicated. Thank you, Joe, for the question. And sorry for the long answer, but that's how I get sometimes. any other questions before we finish? So our retreat's coming up. If you want to join us, May 11th to 14th, there's info on the website. The book I just mentioned will be, the Kindle version's out now. And I think the paperback will be out tomorrow, but there'll be info on the website too about that. So let's finish with the Metta Sutta like we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an ongoing expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, excuse me, freed from outward and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.